Welcome to the Sunstone Podcast, everyone. The holiday season is just around the corner, and I have a little present for you. John Larson sent me a podcast episode from his mysterious hideout in the North Pole. Happily, that means that you'll be hearing his velvety voice in our next episode, due to come out December 23rd. Yes, Virginia, there is a John Larson. But for this episode, you get me. And I want to present you with my totally rational, completely rooted in the facts, utterly not crazy, Christmas Carol conspiracy theory. The theory that will change how you look at Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol forever. I started thinking about A Christmas Carol because my daughter is in a production of it this year. The theater company has been performing its play adaptation every year for 35 years, and it's very popular. There are more than 450 seats in the theater, and they perform the play all through December, at least twice a day on weekdays, and four times a day on weekends. And they always sell out. In fact, they often add extra performances, which also sell out. And the play isn't part of the season tickets either. People have to buy these tickets separately. So what that means is that more than 30,000 people pay to see this particular production each year. And that's just one theater. There are at least a dozen other Christmas Carol productions just locally. To me, it's extraordinary that so many people would be so willing to see a play they've probably already seen a dozen times before. And not just willing to see it, but excited enough to see it to pay money. I actually found out later that the production team actually calls A Christmas Carol the second Christmas story, which is quite a thing to say. So, when my wife and I went to see the production, she said that the man sitting next to her, the man who wasn't me, was weeping at the end of the play. And that reminded me of something that happened to me a few years ago. A friend who was an administrator at a theater gave me tickets to their Christmas Carol production. And the next time I saw him, I thanked him for the tickets and said that the play had inspired me to donate. "To the theater?" he asked. He was obviously very happy. And I was like, no, to the local food bank. So, A Christmas Carol has had an effect on me, too. And while I was watching this particular production that has my daughter in it, I could feel the various strings of my heart being pulled, and I thought, yeah, this is a good story. But then, afterward, I started to realize that, by most measures, A Christmas Carol is absolutely not a good story. I guess I should be careful saying something like that in public, since, like any good English major, I worship at the altar of Charles Dickens. He really was an extraordinary writer, and I admire him hugely. And I also run the risk of A Christmas Carol lover, of whom there are at least 30,000 in Utah, throwing a peppermint-scented Molotov cocktail through my window. Besides, what other story has been graced by both George C. Scott and the Muppets? Something about it has to be working. But let's think about it. What's wrong with A Christmas Carol? Well, first of all, Scrooge is a passive character. Most good stories focus on a character who wants something and, you know, overcomes obstacles to get it. And in especially good stories, the character has to go through a change of heart or behavior in order to obtain his or her goal. Sometimes he or she even has to give up on the goal. But in A Christmas Carol's case, Scrooge has no real goal but to be left alone. And that goal, you know, goes out the window as soon as Marley shows up. And Scrooge doesn't really take any real action to regain his solitude. So Scrooge's desires aren't what this story's about. Instead, we watch Scrooge being led around by ghosts, taking him on a Victorian version of This Is Your Life. And Scrooge even gives up on resisting the ghosts after the Ghost of Christmas Past. In fact, he even seems to start egging them on. He's encouraging them to get to the moral of the scenario being played out in front of him. In fact, when Future comes along, it's Scrooge that's doing the moralizing. He's doing the work for the ghost. Do you remember in high school when your teacher would force you to read some Greek tragedy or other and then teach you about Deus ex machina, the gods coming down from the ceiling of the stage on a platform in order to resolve the character's problems? The fact that this kind of thing happened all the time in ancient Greek plays means that it was okay with the ancient Greeks if the gods just came down and fixed things, even in their drama. But Deus ex machina is kind of a letdown in most modern storytelling, because it takes responsibility away from the main character. It says, yeah, the main character struggled, but it didn't really matter, because the gods were just waiting for the right time to step in and fix things. The character doesn't have to grow or change. He or she just has to be saved. The thing is, as my brother pointed out, A Christmas Carol is almost 100% Deus ex machina. As soon as Scrooge's character flaws are revealed at the beginning of the play, Marley's ghost comes in and sets off this chain reaction of gods whose sole purpose is to save Scrooge. It's flattering to have all that attention, but it doesn't ask anything of Scrooge's character. He just has to follow them around like he's going on a Disneyland ride in Fantasyland, you know. Oh, you remember that part of the movie? Ah, Snow White, Peter Pan, whatever. And they give him no choice but to follow him anyway. He is trapped in the God's machine. And then there's the ending. When Scrooge wakes up to find out that all the terrible things the spirits have shown him have not yet come to pass, that he's still able to change things, he jumps around and giggles, describing himself as being as giddy as a schoolboy. And then he begins to lavish money everywhere, surprising everyone who knew him before, and the narrator tells us that he was a great benefactor from then on. It seems, I don't know, utterly fanciful that someone could in fact go through such a complete personality transformation so quickly. None of his decades of routine or habits of thinking remain. How lucky he is to gain a kind of salvation just by letting three ghosts haunt him. I'd totally go for that if it would help me dump my character flaws in one evening. But, of course, we know that something like Scrooge's transformation could never happen in real life. And that, sadly, it's never going to happen to us. It's a fantasy. And yet, we go to the play and eat it with a spoon every year. It makes grown men cry. Why is that? What makes A Christmas Carol so effective at what it does? I started to get my first clue when I realized that Scrooge's transition from a lonely but loving child and a Twitter-pated suitor to a money-obsessed miser takes up exactly zero time in the action. We simply transition from Fezziwig's party, where Scrooge is wooing Belle, to the scene where she breaks up with him because he's given his heart to money instead. Why in the world do we accept this sudden transition? Isn't that the kind of change that usually takes up a huge part of most stories? I mean, usually we demand to see the fall of a character because it helps us to understand how the character got to this point in the first place and thus how they need to move forward. But no, Scrooge simply changes. No explanations are offered. As I thought about it, it reminded me of the movie Drive, where, you remember, maybe you don't, I don't know, have you seen it? I like it. But in the main character, his name is simply Driver, the elegant Ryan Gosling. And he appears on the screen with absolutely no past. He simply is who he is. So Drive confused me when I first saw it, because it seemed to be a car chase movie, but then it didn't act like a car chase movie. Then it looked like a love story, but it didn't act like a love story. Then it looked like a heist movie, but it didn't act like a heist movie. And I was thinking to myself, the story could take care of all these problems if Driver only had a backstory. But then I realized, the story didn't want us to treat Driver as a character, because then we'd be thinking of him as being separate from ourselves, as having a story that was unlike our own. But the story wanted us to see Driver as representing our own soul. It wanted to show us how a lost soul can navigate a fallen world while groping toward life. And the story was giving us the biggest hint it knew how to give by taking out one of the things we most expect from a character, a backstory. I think that's what A Christmas Carol is doing. By completely skipping over the pivotal story of how Scrooge came to be a money-obsessed miser, Dickens is breaking down the barrier between Scrooge and us by removing the particulars of the stories of his fall. Now, why would Dickens do that? Maybe it's because he understood that there's a miser in every one of us. You know, there's a part of ourselves that has cut ourselves off from love, from community, frankly, from our own selves, in pursuit of security and control. We put together a tiny alcove in which we circulate our life energy, spinning it around and around ourselves, going nowhere. I think it's defensible to say that the story of Scrooge is meant to be the story of some part of us. You know, maybe we're not literally misers, but there is a part of our soul that certainly is. And we can't point to a particular moment when we became misers and allowed love and community to wander so far away that we eventually came to revile it, as Scrooge does, seeing it as, you know, a drain on the energies that we guard so closely. You remember Scrooge says to those two guys who come to get his donations, "Do I not pay my taxes? Do those not already take care of the workhouses and the jails?" So the miser inside us already feels, like Scrooge does, that the world is sucking us dry without our consent. Why would we offer more? But we don't remember when we started believing that giving to the community was a burden. So, with this premise that Scrooge is us, how does that affect the way we see the rest of the story? Well, first, as I've just pointed out, it lets us know that at some level, Scrooge is a part of us. But then, it does something really interesting. It helps us to love this shadowy part of ourselves. Remember when Christmas Past starts her tour? She shows young Ebenezer, yet again, left alone at his boarding school during Christmas. An abandoned child in an uncaring environment. Perhaps we haven't experienced that kind of a situation literally, but we know what it's like to feel abandoned. We know what it's like to be alone, especially when we were young and vulnerable. And we start to realize that that was where our miser had his beginnings. In abandonment. The miser knows what it's like to try to live without the energy of loved ones or a community, how he needed to store his own energy and protect it in order to survive. And when you've learned that lesson, when you've been wounded by it, it's almost impossible to unlearn it because it's rooted in such a deep part of our psyche. Next, Christmas Past brings Scrooge to Fezziwig's party, where he, and we, remember the gush of youth when our brains and bodies were flowing with hormones and poetry, when we felt that the world really meant something, or that we could make meaning from it. And she finally shows Scrooge the pivotal scene that led to his current condition, where he shut life out by shutting out Belle. And we see there our own current plight. At some level, there is a miser inside of us. So Christmas Past is there to teach us that we need to remember our wounds, but we also need to remember our idealism. And we need to remember that at some level, we too shut life out in order to protect ourselves. Then Christmas Present takes control. He has a completely different function. He's there to show Scrooge the results of his miserhood. I know, it seems like an obvious thing to say. I mean, he brings Scrooge to two scenes where he's roundly mocked and disparaged. It doesn't seem like the sort of thing a jolly spirit should be doing, but I think all that jolliness, all that laughter, is to smooth the way toward telling an unvarnished truth about the consequences of our miserhood. Like Scrooge, our inner miser has all the reasons in the world to do what he does, and they're based in experience, as the spirit of Christmas past showed us, but that doesn't do anything to mitigate the consequences of our attitude and our behavior. Those consequences are real, and we need to know that. Christmas Present would be doing us no favors by softening the blow. This is what's happening right now, as a consequence of the miser. His family mocks him, his employee's family despises him, and the life of a little boy will be cut short. And then the pivotal moment of Present's visit occurs as he reveals two starving children, a boy named Ignorance and a girl named Want. These are the two major causes of suffering in the world, Present says. But the worst of the two is ignorance. Now, I'll admit, I didn't really get Present's reasoning on that one. It seems like it's Maslow 101 that you have to feed a body before you can feed a mind. But I'll assume he knows what he's talking about for now. Now, at this point, Scrooge is sufficiently humiliated and freaked out by everything Present showed him that I personally think he could have woken up right then and gone on to be a good contributing member of society, you know, donating to food banks and supporting orphanages. He might even have attended a party or two, just so that he could speak up for himself. But strangely, the story isn't done with him yet. He's not a miser anymore. What more does the story want from him? At first I thought maybe it was just to freak Scrooge out and us a little bit more. I mean, it gets really macabre from here, with people crawling around Scrooge's bedroom where his dead body is still lying, stealing his stuff. One of them even steals the shirt right off his cooling body, and then they go off and laugh about it. So after seeing all of this, Scrooge finally says, please, Spirit, show me someone with compassion for this man. And strangely, Christmas Future brings him to the Cratchit house, where the family is mourning, not Scrooge, but the death of Tiny Tim. Why in the world are we here? I wondered. These people aren't mourning Scrooge. Then Future brings Scrooge to a cemetery where Scrooge thinks Tim is buried. But he doesn't see the green place that Bob Cratchit had described. Instead, he sees, you know, an angular, stony, lifeless graveyard. And soon enough, surprise, surprise, his own name on the gravestone. I've got to admit, I've always been bugged by the way Christmas Present and Christmas Future played these things out. Their scenes seem to be beating Scrooge into submission. First with humiliation, then with guilt, then with, you know, a solitary death and the desecration of his corpse, and finally, to top it all off, an ignominious burial. It seems like the message is, be nice or else. And then Scrooge wakes up so glad to be able to escape all that, and he goes out and he changes all of his behavior. And that just rings hollow to me. I admit I make changes in my behavior when something really scares me, or when I feel guilty about something, or when I'm trying to avoid humiliation. But frankly, the change never sticks. The original impetus for the change loses its potency pretty soon, and my motivation dies along with it. It reminds me of that joke about the guy who's really late for an important flight, and while he's driving around the airport parking lot, he prays, "Please, God, just help me to find a parking space, and I promise I'll go to church again." Suddenly, a car backs out of his stall in front of him, and he says, "Never mind, God, I got it." But if Scrooge's motivation is all based in fear and guilt, why would the story be so effective as to be one of the most popular stories in the English language for almost 150 years? I finally figured it out when I paid attention to the most annoying character in the story. Yep, Tiny Tim. "God bless us all, everyone!" I was always annoyed that the story lavished so much attention on this kid. It seemed so lazy. I'll just make this kid scrawny, sickly, and lame, but with a heart of gold. That'll make everyone love him. I know. I'm the world's most evil person. You should really know that about me before we get much further in our relationship. But Scrooge and Tiny Tim are the pair we tend to see the most when we see representations of the story. You know, Scrooge carrying Tiny Tim on his shoulder. It's iconic, right? Why is that? Why do these two need to be united in order for the story to pack its final wallop? You're going to make fun of me when I say this, but I think Tiny Tim represents the young, abandoned Ebenezer Scrooge we met with Christmas Past. We thought young Scrooge was just an object of pity, but it turns out that he was the ghost Scrooge had been running from his entire life. He just didn't know it. Which is why, I have to admit now, Christmas Present was right. Ignorance is the cause of most of the suffering in the world, because in our ignorance of our wounded child selves, we become divided from ourselves, and in a desperate effort to avoid ever being wounded again, we become misers, leaving want to prowl the world. So this is why Christmas Future brought Scrooge to the Cratchit house, when Scrooge asked to see someone who was mourning the dead man. Metaphorically, Scrooge and Tim are the same person. So the death of Scrooge was also the death of Tim. Finally, we get to the point of the story. The only way Scrooge could save himself and rise out of his miserhood was to save Tim. Because by doing so, he was saving himself. This, I think, is what makes grown men and women cry when they watch A Christmas Carol. They get to see the reunification of themselves with their wounded childhood self. They get to feel some of the healing that attends that reunification. And they know that, indeed, when that unification happens, generosity simply erupts. The miraculous transformation really does happen. Not because we're frightened of being cast out socially if we aren't nice people, or even because we want to make the world a better place, but because we operate from a place of wholeness. We have access to a vast reservoir of soul energy that we'd completely forgotten about when we'd started building our protective barriers. And we know that it can never be emptied. That's why Scrooge goes around lavishing money on everybody. His wealth, which was once limited, is now limitless. I'll admit that I was kind of skeptical about this production company's veneration of A Christmas Carol. I mean, they practically treat it like scripture. In a letter they sent out to cast members, they'd said, "It's so important that we honor the original text of Dickens as much as possible in our storytelling. That is why I believe we have one of the most accurate, if not the most accurate, text in the version of our script." It's kind of like those Bible movies that will only use direct quotes from the King James text in their dialogue. But now I'm starting to see their point. In fact, I'm even beginning to understand why they call it the second Christmas story. The original Christmas story is about a child who was born to save us. And A Christmas Carol shows us that, yes indeed, a child is the only one who can save us. But we have to save the child first. In fact, now that I think about it, A Christmas Carol acts a lot like scripture. Okay, hear me out. I know it sounds kind of funny. But when it's functioning correctly, scripture, like all good literature, operates on two levels. The literal level and the metaphorical level. You know, it gives literal commandments, and it shows us how to live through its stories. Unless you're in the Old Testament, in which, you know, take it with a grain of salt. Maybe even a pillar of salt. But its stories are also metaphors that point us toward deeper truths. And Christmas Carol does just that. It fulfills its literal function when people like me, hardened, cynical misers, are moved enough to go donate to a food bank afterward. That's good for the community, and it's good for me. But it also points us toward an essential truth that we need to unify ourselves in order to access our fathomless selves, and thus our fathomless generosity. Now, I don't know if people actually think about all this when they see the play or the movie or, heaven forbid, when they read the story. If they do, they certainly never told me about it. Maybe it was because they were too busy making fun of me at Christmas parties I didn't attend. Which is too bad, because it took me almost half a century to figure it out. But even if we don't see that truth directly, we do feel it tugging at us. And little by little, I'd argue that it leads us in the right direction. God bless us, everyone, eh? Well, after you're done donating to the food bank and reuniting with your inner child, can I nudge you to head over to sunstone.org/donate and deposit a little holiday cheer in our basket? It really does take a lot of time and effort to produce these podcasts, publications, and events that we do, and we never make any money off of it. We survive, frankly, on donations. And hey, we are a nonprofit, so you can deduct your donation from your taxes. In any case, thanks for being a listener. I enjoy your company. We'll see you again next week.